live from New York, it's The Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about vitamin D and how it can help your immune system, and how not having enough selenium can impact your life by 6.8 years, and how these new testosterone drugs, well, they can impact your testosterone, but the side effects, heart attacks. Feeling impulsive or frustrated? Take a nap. And more. Lots more on health and healing. Then a lot of other topics. We're going to deal with frack quack madness. 35 fracking earthquakes, Rock, Oklahoma, in a week. They used to have zero. We're also going to take a look at I Think America's Out of Hand, the shocking numbers that reveal just how burnt out American workers actually are. Productivity has exploded, but at what cost? The American workforce in recent years, it's just devastated their health. Also, for those who thought, well, the pro-vaccine group won in California. Yeah, temporarily. The lawsuits will follow now. But I believe, as does Mike Adams from Natural News, that there's going to be a big backlash on the vaccine industry because the truth will now come out. I'll share some things with you that the mainstream media and Pacifica's KPFA, siding with, like it or not, the vaccine industry, didn't want you to know. This audience will know the truth. And we're going to target Merck today. Merck is the biggest maker of vaccines out there. They paid the most for the votes. Smart business. Very easy in America. Give a lot of these state legislators money, and you can pretty well imagine what comes after that, their vote. So we're going to show you what Merck is not going to be happy about. But do I really care what Merck thinks? Not at all. Take a vaccine for that, Merck. We'll come back to you. I can promise you, you're not going to be forgotten. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. Oh, and gee whiz, Donald Trump is now number two in the top Republicans. Wow, could you imagine a country run by him? And there are a lot of people believe that he is just right. And I was watching to see how they handled it on Fox. And I listened to different commentators, from Bill O'Reilly and the group at 5 and at 6 and so I'm going to share a different perspective on Donald Trump. And then you'll have a chance to see the side that they're not talking about at all. So the other side of Donald Trump, a little later on today. Vitamin D, we know we need it, we just don't get enough of it. Now, if you're out in the sun, but you're lathered all up with sunscreen, you're not going to get it. If you have dark skin, dark pigments in the skin, you're not going to get enough. But you can also get sunburn. A lot of people are not aware of that. So what should we do? According to Penn State University, as well as a study group out of University of Cape Town, South Africa, vitamin D will help your immune system. But if you have HIV, it really helps your immune system. Quote, this is from University of Cape Town. Already commonly prescribed for elderly men and women to keep their bones strong, vitamin D supplements could also be an easy and affordable way to fight serious infections like HIV, according to a study led by Penn State anthropology professor. Goes on to talk about what we have found when using vitamin D and how it works. Let's go back in time. One of our former producers, Doug Henderson, found the press conference where I had 100 people with full-blown AIDS and their physicians and their medical records and a panel of scientists, independent scientists, who had reviewed these, took a year to put this together. 7,000 invitations to the American media went out to all the AIDS organizations, to the gay aid groups such as ACT UP, that were supporting Big Pharma at that time, though it had split in two. One group wanted more natural approaches, the other wanted to go the hard way, and they both believed in their mission. But they could have come to see and question and the relevance of a natural, non-toxic approach. We had a panel of physicians who had worked at the Tri-State Healing Center who had administered the protocols that I had created. Now, mine were 12 of the 100. All the rest were from around the country using different techniques. Dr. Cathcart with vitamin C, his patients were there. Louise Hay had two patients there. So a whole group of natural, non-toxic approaches to helping the system. And in one of the papers that was presented there, one of the individuals was talking about vitamin D at very high doses. In fact, there was nothing in the medical literature that could support that high a dose, and yet it was with that high a dose that this person was able to go from near death to recovered health. And then other treatments were used, natural treatments in addition to that, but that's what was there, and we had all the papers on vitamin D. And one of the suggestions was that what if we had an overall protocol that no matter what your background or state of health, let's say you had pneumocystis or you had Kaposi's sarcoma or you had thrush, whatever you had, chronic diarrhea. Believe it or not, people die all over the world every day of chronic diarrhea from bad water, infection, cystosomiasis. And people with AIDS at that time were dying of diarrhea. So I put together a protocol and I published a textbook. And the publisher was so concerned that it be accepted that he hired an outside independent professor, James Feast, who was the editor. That Professor Feast is highly respected, and he is a real scholar. And every single one of the 3,900-plus citations were reviewed and found accurate. And it has about 169 pages of just natural approaches to AIDS-defining illnesses. The rest of it was about other aspects of AIDS. In any case, here we had all these people, independent scientists, physicians from around the United States, persons with AIDS who were all in good health, 12 fully recovered and completely reversed their HIV condition. Not a single member, not one member of the AIDS community or the press showed up, not one. So it's very easy to say something doesn't exist if you're not willing to give it an airing. Interesting, at the time, I had told the program director and the station manager, WBAI, our sister station in New York, also KPFK, also PFW in Washington, where I was airing, would they send a reporter to cover it? No one showed up. Why? I was later told, well, because the people who, from ACT UP, they control virtually everything here when it comes to this. And, you know, I'll tell you exactly what he said. He said, just think of it as medical McCarthyism. That's exactly his words. The program director, WBAI, he was right. Now we've found the tape. So I intend to air this in its entirety in the next week. Plus a discussion with Arthur Ashe at the Apollo Theater when I was talking about AIDS and brought people up on the stage who had full-blown AIDS recovered, and he was there. And the dialogue that he and I had, and later it spilled over onto Tony Brown's Journal, Channel 13. So just understand, there was a whole lot of work being done, a whole lot of people getting well, but using natural methods and not the drugs that were killing people by the hundreds of thousands. Now, here's the irony. Listen to this irony. The people who were getting money from drug companies to promote AZT and DDI and DDC and protease inhibitors, millions, hundreds of millions of dollars collectively to journalists and activists and their AIDS groups, the media only said they were credible. And for those of us that were actually improving and saving lives and doing it without the drugs, no form at all. And that's how it works. So this study shows, gee whiz, that in two universities, but now today they can say that vitamin D helps people with HIV. And we were doing it back in 1984. Subnormal amounts of selenium, a very important mineral. You can get it from mushrooms. You can get it from onions. You can take a 200 microgram tablet. This is from the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and it says, quote, that decreased serum selenium levels and a greater risk of death in older populations over a period of 6.8 years. Quote, about half of the selenium in the whole blood is bound to plasma, of which selenoprotein usually constitutes more than 60%, and glutathione peroxidase constitutes 25%, and that older people are not getting it. So, here's the deal. If you're over the age of 50 and you want to live a longer life, just make sure you're getting selenium each day, either as supplements, easy, 200 micrograms, or in your foods. Now, a lot of men in America are watching those ads on television and say, is your depression, is your lack of libido, is your lack of muscle and all this other, is this due to low testosterone? Well, good news. Take this drug. Yeah? If you have low T, that's what they're calling it, testosterone therapy, you can improve your testosterone. But understand the reality. Low T is a great way for the pharmaceutical industry to profit off male issues. Over 5 million prescriptions for testosterone have been written in the United States so far, and it's helping people with muscle loss, decreased libido, and lower bone density and mood. But you can do this naturally. I gave you the protocol for it on yesterday's program. Now, here's the problem. Men who undergo testosterone treatment, orthodox treatment, the one you see advertised on television, quote, you'll increase your risk of stroke, heart attack, and premature death. Let me repeat that. Get an erection and die. That's what it means. So I'd rather have my life and health and build my testosterone naturally than to take a drug and have a stroke. So that's what it's showing. Quote, studies showing these risks and adverse effects prompted the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to take action. And for the Food and Drug Administration to react, you know, it has to be pretty bad. The FDA released a safety announcement warning consumers the potential risk of testosterone therapy and that they would be conducting more investigations in the matter. Two studies in particular raised alarm bells, one published in the Journal of American Medical Association, the other in PLOS One. The results showed that testosterone therapy users experienced a 200 to a 300% increase in heart attacks within 90 days of starting treatment. So, go back to yesterday's program. If you don't have it, go to the archives. I give you a full protocol for a natural, non-toxic, positive way of helping your testosterone levels. And finally, feeling impulsive and frustrated, a lot of people do, take a nap. From the University of Michigan, and this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Personality and Individual Differences, taking a nap may be an effective strategy to counteract impulsive behavior and to boost tolerance for frustration. It's becoming increasingly common for people, especially adults, to not sleep an entire night. This can negatively impair a person's attention span and memory, also contributing to fatigue. University of Michigan researchers examined how a brief nap affected adults' emotional control. The study participants, 18 years to 50 years of age, maintained a consistent sleep schedule for 3 nights prior to the test. And then during the test, they found that they either didn't have the nap, one group, or did have the nap, and the nap that had the group were not frustrated, were not impulsive, had more energy. Quote, our results suggest that napping may be a beneficial intervention for individuals who may be required to remain awake for long periods of time by enhancing the ability to preserve through difficult or frustrating tasks. Well, how about students? That's one. How about people working as flight attendants? How about school teachers? How about people who, you know, have to go long periods of time with a high degree of focus? You're the ones who need the naps the most. That's our health and nutrition. We're going to take a look at the environment now. And this is something that we're seeing a phenomena over and over again. This is from Emerson Urie Enviro News. Quote, historically speaking, Oklahoma used to be a place where almost no palpable earthquakes happened at all. But hydraulic fracturing, fracking, has changed all that. In 1 week, Through June 24th, 2015, Oklahoma was jolted by 35 earthquakes greater than magnitude 3.0 due to fracking and fracking wastewater injection activities in Oklahoma's Geological Survey. And this in a state that experienced less than 2 quakes per year before 2009. And this goes, they're going, quote, below the deepest rock formations, believed to be the one of the main causes of quakes. All right, so quaking is causing, or fracking is causing quakes. And they've been able to verify that in Texas, in England, in Alabama, and Ohio. And Oklahoma just happens to have 3,200 saltwater injection wells. And many of those are in areas where the water-to-oil ratio is very poor. And unlike situations in Kansas and other states where particular injection wells have been definitively linked to seismic events, in Oklahoma the situation is complex. So it took a lot of time to really study this, and then they came up with, yeah, it's the cause. So here's the likelihood you're going to have a bigger quake out there, and some of these smaller quakes could be opening up fissures, cracks, in the earth, allowing the fracking water, millions of gallons, to go into aquifers and wells. If you didn't have the quake, you wouldn't have that seismic activity. So mind you, if you have an aquifer that's 100 feet or 50 feet below where you're drilling or off to a side, that little earthquake you just had can make a crack, and now you've got a place for the water to go and pollute the other person's water. We should put a moratorium on all gas hydrofracking in the United States. Also, for those of you who are concerned about what just happened in California, and many are, because we had science, real science, on our side, showing that there was no safety or efficacy in the vaccines being mandated in California. We also had thousands upon thousands of parents whose children were injured and had proof of injury from vaccines. We had physicians, including specialists, board-certified pediatricians like Tony Bark and others, who went out but were not allowed to testify. But all the lobbyists for Merck were there, and that's unfortunate. So here are the reasons that some of us believe that there'll be a backlash. And this is composed from Mike Adams, Natural News, quote, as Merck virologists already stated on the record in sworn government documents, Merck knowingly falsified its mumps vaccine test results to fabricate a 95% efficacy rate when it did not exist. In order to do this, Merck spiked the blood test with animals' antibodies in order to artificially inflate the appearance of immune system antibodies. And just as an aside, if you get a result from an animal antibody test that has no relevance at all to a human antibody test, and we're supposed to believe that a vaccine is safe and effective because you create antibodies, that has never been proven. It is only speculative, because we've seen people with no antibodies who've been protected, and we've seen people with high antibodies end up with the disease. And by the way, the woman who was just told, oh, you know, we found the woman who died, well, she was fully vaccinated. So exactly how did that work? You had a fully vaccinated woman for the measles, and she died? Then why don't you look at what you did wrong in the hospital, or the how ineffective that was in her system? Also, Merck then used the falsified trial results to swindle the U.S. government out of hundreds of millions of dollars for a vaccine that does not provide adequate immunization. Merck's vaccine fraud was actually contributed to the continuation of mumps across America, causing more children to become infected with mumps. Merck used its false claims of 95% effectiveness to monopolize the vaccine market and eliminate possible competitors. Merck's vaccine fraud has been going on since the late 1990s, says the Merck virologist whistleblowers. And why weren't those whistleblowers? We now have 5 vaccine industry scientists from different companies all saying that they lied, the figures manipulated on vaccine safety and efficacy. Why weren't one of those involved in coming before Congress or the state legislature in California to tell the truth. Testing of Merck's vaccine was never done against real-world mumps viruses in the wild. Instead, test results were simply falsified to achieve the desired outcome. That is a fraud. Why isn't the Attorney General of the United States investigating? Oh, I forgot. We all know about attorney generals. This entire fraud took, quote, place with the knowledge, authority, and approval of Merck senior management. Then why aren't they personally being held accountable? Why aren't they being shamed? Merck scientists, quote, witnessed firsthand the improper testing of data and falsification in which Merck engaged and artificially inflated the vaccine's efficacy findings. That's according, end quote, to the court documents. That's where I just read that. So, one more reason that sooner or later, even with a completely compliant media in California, this information will find the light of day, and in many of the court cases coming up, I'm sure that this will come out. Also, this is from Matt Sacaro from Salon. Quote, the American worker is overworked, underpaid, and suffering from severe burnout. This sentiment isn't populist rhetoric. There are numbers to back it up. A new study from Workplace Trends and HR-focused research firm polled over 2,500 workers and researched troubling results. According to the data, 53% of American workers report feeling burned out at work. With current working conditions, it's easy to see why. A study concluded smartphones and tablets enable employers to further colonize a worker's time to the tune of 2 extra hours per day, since they can be reached at all hours. In a Gallup estimated the poll, the typical American work week was 47 hours, not 40. The American worker was tolling for almost a full extra day. Of the workers this recent study polled, more than half worked a day longer than 8 hours. Quote, this isn't the workplace of 10 years ago, said the author of the study. There's a lot of pressure, and it's competitive in the sense that anyone in the world could take your job for less money, so you have to work harder. So, here are my thoughts. First, I want to ask my engineer if we're able to get calls in now, because we have all of our lines. Good, we can. So here's our question. Why haven't all the students in America, and maybe students listening can address this, or teachers, join with teachers at all universities and colleges and gone on strike until the debt on student loans is forgiven, the laws are rewritten to allow bankruptcy, and zero interest for any student loan. So students are not burdened with this. Because who are the people working so hard? More often than not, it's young people getting out of school, and they're not able to get a job, more often than not, in the field that they've gotten their degree, so they have to go work at menial work that didn't require a college degree, and then they have to compete against everyone else who's looking for work and is willing to work harder or longer, and so they begin to burn out. Well, when you get out of college, you're already burnt out. You need a rest period. So now they're out of college and in graduate school, and they're having to do extra work and paid minimal. I believe that a general strike of unifying, bringing people together and saying, this is intolerable, this is inhumane, this is not the way education should be. And just on that level, I'm not talking about the curriculum, I'm not talking about teaching, I'm just talking now about joining together all students and all faculty to go on strike and close down all educational institutions until the students are unburdened and no longer have to live in debt, peonage, and stress for the rest of their lives. Your thoughts on this issue, please, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Now, here are my thoughts on Donald Trump before we take our break. The Republicans are very happy with him, by and large, so there's a lot of infighting, some wanting Bush, Jeb Bush, others wanting some of the other characters. Here's what no one is talking about, and I thought I'd share this. First, he talks about how he would negotiate better deals, okay, that he's this What, worth $8 or $9 billion? All right. Well, then why didn't you also take credit, Mr. Trump, for your Chapter 11 bankruptcy four times? In a period of 17 years, you had 19 failed businesses. Companies were given debt relief, came with specific terms that you, Donald Trump, no longer be in charge of such as the Taj Mahal and Trump Plaza Hotel. How many hundreds of millions of dollars did those people lose? Also, there's one thing when you're a self-made person you weren't. Your father, Fred Trump, gave you an inheritance that's been estimated as low as $40 and high as $200 million. Nice way to start your life. Your father founded the Trump Organization. You didn't. You became president of your dad's business in 1974 at 28 years of age. However, by 1990, you had accumulated $5 billion in debt. In 2004, Trump Hotels and Casinos filed Chapter 11. In 2009, Trump Entertainment filed Chapter 11 for the third time and has stated on the record, quote, "I do play with bankruptcy laws. They're very good for me." Good for you? How about the investors? In the early 1990s, Trump personally, not his companies, had $900 million of personal debt. His companies had $3.5 billion in corporate debt. Trump Shuttles, remember the airplane in 1988, one of the least profitable airlines ever. He had a plan to buy an airline and make them more expensive by featuring maplewood veneer floors and chrome-seated belts and gold-plated toilet fittings. His planes became known as the Flying Golden Toilets, but apparently never took any customers that far off the ground and went broke. The Catcher, he financed it with $380 million loans from 22 banks. Not one ever saw a dollar. And since he defaulted on the loans, the banks repossessed the assets. Trump Ocean Resort Bega, a project that got $32 million from investors. Then he sent them a letter stating that the loan negotiations collapsed and the buildings that were supposed to be built didn't exist. He quit the project quickly and then told investors they were lucky. If the buildings had ever been built, they would have lost more money. Trump makes money and protects himself by countersuing those who sue him. In the case of the Ocean Resort, when the developer Iron Gate sued him, he filed suit for $8 million more. Iron Gate went bankrupt before the suit started. How about Trump Mortgage? Started in 2006, he claimed it would be America's number one home lender. In a year and a half, it closed. How about Trump Tonic? Didn't hear that? Created in 2006, Trump predicted his tonic vodka would be the most requested drink in the United States. Apparently, the company just exists as a mirage and doesn't make any vodka now. How about the Deutsche Bank suit? Trump borrowed $640 million from Deutsche Bank to finance Chicago Trump Tower and hotel. He kept a lot hidden from the bank on personal guarantees to others. So when the bank asked to be paid back, when the time came to back almost all of that amount, he sued them for $3 billion. When Trump fails in his businesses, he likes to claim force majeure, forces beyond anyone's control. This is why he said the housing market crash was literally an act of God. How about Trump Tower Tampa? 2006, you broke ground for a 50-story luxury apartment building in Tampa. Went bust quickly. How about Go Trump, launched in 2006, a travel power search engine to travel Trump style, was shut down in 2007. How about Trump the Magazine? 2007, his attempt, third attempt at a luxury magazine on lifestyle of the elite, folded in 2009. How about Trump University? Not much of a real school, just charges $35,000 for a gold seminar to impart Trump's secrets at success in business. Class action suits have been filed against it for misleading marketing claims. Attorney General New York State opened an investigation into its deceptions. How about hubris over his worth? A New York Times author wrote that Trump only had $250 million, so Trump sued him for $5 billion. Whenever someone undervalues his worth, he aggressively responds and threatens suit. 2011, Forbes valued him at $200 million, but Trump argued he was worth 15 times as much. He threatened to sue a stockbroker who predicted the Taj Mahal casino would fail. How about the Ground Zero Mosque? He offered to pay $7.5 million to prevent a community center with a prayer room, not truly a mosque, from being built 5 full blocks from the ground zero. In 1989, he created Trump the Game Board for kids with his picture on the $50 million toy money, like Monopoly, except all the properties in the game were his. Like he likes to complain that too much stuff is made in China and that there is no more manufacturing in the United States. He told Fox that China, quote, makes crap, but then his own clothesline, made in China and Bangladesh. On immigration, that's where he seems to be getting a challenge now. As usual, Trump has got his statistics wrong. Doesn't hurt, even when you're trying to become president, to have a little knowledge of facts, though none of our presidents now or previously have had any knowledge of truth on their side, but they're really very personable. For example, blaming immigrants for rape. Oh, as Bill O'Reilly did last night for a whole segment, lathering at the mouth, right, Bill? Because one guy committed a murder in San Francisco, you got to make that one guy who was arrested 5 times and that it's a sanctuary city, you got to make that the whole cause. Did you look at any of the other murders that occurred? Who murdered whom? No. From the National Sex Offenders Public website, 56% of forcible rape suspects are white, 31% are black, leaving the remainder of other minorities, including Latino, as one of the least. In 2014, the University of Massachusetts study in the Justice Quarterly Foreign-Born, quote, individuals exhibit remarkably low levels of involvement in crime across their life course, end quote. So Sean, and who's that strange-looking woman? What was her name? Ann Coulter. Ann, you love to be quoted as an expert. I'm not sure on what, but you sure don't like these Latinos, do you? Well, why don't you take a look? They're the least likely to be committing crimes, according to the actual research. And, quote, from the Pew Research study, shows the same. Quote, crime among first-generation immigrants is significantly lower than overall crime rates of the second generation and natives. From 2014 Northwestern University study, quote, there is essentially no correlation between immigrants and violent crime. Let me repeat that. Bill, quote, there is essentially no correlation between immigrants and violent crime. From 2008, Public Policy Institute of California, immigrants are underrepresented in California prisons compared to their representation in the overall population. That means that even though there are a lot of immigrants, they're not in prison because they're not committing crimes. 2008, University of California study, incarceration rates are among young men are lowest for immigrants, even those who are the least educated. So you say we're not getting the best and brightest from Mexico, so we're getting these rapists? Why aren't the statistics showing that? Why aren't our prisons filled with them? Of all people, Senator Ted Cruz came to Trump's defense on NBC Meet the Press. Boy, I wouldn't want him ever coming to my defense about anything. Trump also misquoted the Fusion article where he got his wacky idea. The actual article states that, quote, 80% of incidents of Central African girls and women being raped occur while they are en route trying to enter the United States. You got to understand how many countries they go through and how bad it is when you start off in El Salvador, you start off in Guatemala, you start off in any of the countries coming north. You're going thousands, thousands of miles. You're alone. It's not while they're in the United States. Many of corporate allies are now leaving him, including Univision, which dropped his Miss America pageant. NBC dropped his Miss USA pageant, Miss Universe, and The Apprentice. Macy's is going to stop carrying his Trump menswear. Of course, Trump claims he broke his ties with these companies first. Now, what's being left out of this whole picture that no one's talking about? NAFTA. In Mexico. The idea was to push U.S. wages downward towards Mexico's and create new corporate rights in trade. Out of 20 Latin American countries, Mexico ranks 18th with growth of less than 0.9% annually since 1994. Now, during the 1960 to 1980, Mexico per capita gross domestic product doubled, with huge improvements in living standards for most Mexicans. If it had been able to continue at that rate, you would have had Americans going into Mexico because it would have had a higher standard of living. The actual facts show that for 20 years, you had an improvement in standard of living, a reduction in crime for the average person. Then comes around Smiling Bill. You know, the guy that no matter what he does, whatever crimes he's committed, why don't you ever look what he did in Arkansas? When NAFTA consolidated anti-development economic policies and tied Mexico to the United States economy, and for this reason, the stock market bust in 2000. And the small recession 2001 and the great recession 2008 had a bigger impact on Mexico than any other country in Latin America. And after the Great Recession is when the drug war escalated the most. NAFTA also contributed to the right-wing political parties taking control that have destroyed social programs, whereas in the rest of Latin America, with few exceptions, it has been the left that has contributed to economic rebound in Latin American countries that you're seeing today, except for Mexico. NAFTA flooded Mexico with U.S.-subsidized corn that put millions of farmers out of work. And most of this today is GM corn. This led to about 2 million farmers migrating to the United States. And why not? We destroyed their livelihood. We destroyed their capacity to raise food, even for their families. And the U.S. and other Western corporations opened low-wage factories at the expense of unions and the environment. Again, this drove skilled workers to migrate to the United States. NAFTA eliminated 20,000 small and medium-sized Mexican businesses. There were almost 2.5 million illegal Mexicans within a year of NAFTA. By 2006, there were additional 8 million. So why isn't anyone crediting Clinton working with the Republicans to pass NAFTA, and that caused this increase? Do they not know history? Are they not scholarly enough to find the facts? Or is it inconvenient for their ideology and their hate-mongering? The fact is this. The Mexicans are today jobless. Mexico's poverty rate today is the same it was in 1994, 52%. NAFTA promised to lessen the wage gap between U.S. and Mexico workers. In fact, Mexicans earn less today than they did in 1994. So the Mexican political class and the high oligarchs, along with the American political class and oligarchs, we sold out the American worker and we sold out the Mexican worker and family. NAFTA also ushered an orgy of environmental destruction. Agriculture that relies on fossil fuels, chemicals, and GMOs, and excessive water use is what we gave them. There was a large increase in mining activities. NAFTA led to the shortage and collapse of the Mexican peso when it went into effect in 1994. Investors were withdrawing money from Mexico, and Mexico was forced to use its foreign dollar reserves to pay investors. The peso lost 50% of its value in less than a year. We can also thank George Soros for shorting the peso. But don't expect anyone on the left to criticize George Soros. He's smart. He floods money, along with the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, to those in the media, including on Pacifica, and nary a negative word or truth about the real causes. And then the Zapatistas were correct in their predictions when they went public in 1994, the same year NAFTA went into effect. NAFTA, quote, is a death sentence. But why aren't we also looking at the war on drugs? The U.S. has worked with corrupt governments in Central Asia, Middle East, North Africa, the same as with Mexico. It was during President Felipe Calderon from their right-wing party aligned with the Washington consensus that the U.S.-Mexican drug war escalated. It has created the militarization of Mexican police forces, just as we have here. It has increased surveillance on ordinary citizens. The U.S. has used the drug cartel's theater of violence to justify the demonization of immigrants. It's estimated that in 2013, 120,000 people were killed in the drug wars, with an additional 27,000 missing. You can bet that those 120,000 are dead. We're talking about in Mexico. To date, about 100 politicians have been murdered, ones who wouldn't go along. And more reporters, more journalists are killed in Mexico last year than any other country in the world. But when did you see the journalists in the United States report on this and show a courage they have in Mexico, mayors of small communities that try to fight the drug cartels and end up beheaded? Not a word. Human rights groups are reporting that the Mexican government currently employs torture methods similar to those used by the CIA black sites, including waterboarding, asphyxiation in plastic bags, and suspension from limbs and forced nudity. And between 2008 and 2014, the U.S. Congress spent $2.4 billion to fight the drug cartels, including the Meridia Initiative, the security agreement between U.S. and Mexico. It is estimated that 70% of the guns and weapons in the Mexican drug war are from the United States. Also, what Mexico are you speaking about, Donald Trump and the fascist Fox Network? Which exactly are you talking about? I go to Mexico. I speak with the people. As a journalist, I want to know the truth. I never pick up the New York Times. Always have a copy with you in case you get diarrhea when traveling. Outside of that, worthless. Fact. The average American is a decent person, no different than the average decent Mexican. But when is it that we looked at Mexicans as being decent? When did we value their lives? Why don't you go into the villages and see how corrupt many of the politicians have become and how they infiltrate the gangs there with the local young people, and the young people's families are poor. They have no money. They're being displaced. Their father might have come to America, and now they're given money and a gun. And see what impact that has on a child, a young teenager in Mexico. There are hundreds of thousands of these. You take out a drug cartel head. What good does it do? They have 400 to replace in the next moment. It hasn't stopped anything. So you have a government that is corrupt, every government. You have the national police that are corrupt. You have the bankers laundering their money. You have the corporate media protecting them. And you have political parties that defend the politicians, and these politicians don't get elected unless it is with the acknowledgement that they're going to be not going too hard on the drug cartels. Why don't we simply legalize all drugs? You therefore eliminate the profit incentives. If you can't make the profit, you're not going to do the crime. You'll find some other way of making money. Not that you will become anything other than what you were, it's just it's not going to be the same game. So where is all this drugs coming to? Is coming to the United States. Why don't we focus upon why people want these drugs? We're an addicted nation. Why don't we focus on that? Why don't we show an upper middle class or wealthy kid whose family is from a major banking family or major corporate and show what they do? Why don't we show the sexual harassment and rape on the campus? You have more women students being harassed sexually or raped on American campuses than you've ever had with immigrants raping American women. Why don't you focus on that? Why don't you focus upon what's missing in our lives at a spiritual level, an emotional level, a support level? Why don't we show how bad parenting has been for the last 40 years for many people? Why don't we show the corruption of our system, the commodification of life? Why don't we show what it's like to grow up today and have no future because it's been so compromised and so controlled? Was it not Harriet Tubman who said, "I freed 1,000 slaves, and I could have freed more if only they knew they were slaves"? I'm Gary Nall. Trump, the Republicans, the Clinton-Obama Democrats, the entire corporatocracy of Washington, New York, and other cities, our professional class, our academics, why don't you look in the mirror and see what role you have played by your silence or your complicity in the plight of the immigrant? Back in a moment.
Time marches on, never ending. Time keeps its own time. Here we stand at beginning, and end goes passing us by. I can't dream for us all.
We believe, as an America, that we're not prejudice. It's someone else. You don't have to be lynching people. You don't have to be shooting someone to be a racist. What's it like to have a view of yourself that is so removed from reality?
Have you ever stolen anything before?
Hip-hop isn't your favorite genre.
Your lips are huge.
How many baby mamas do you have?
That is not who I am.
That is not who I am.
That is not who I am.
I'm tired of hearing black men are lazy.
Disrespectful.
Violent.
Absent. I think America's got this very interesting history with black men.
America views us one-dimensionally, and for the most part, it's in a negative way.
Comments I hate hearing about black men are...
You grew up in the hood?
You know Shoney likes you because you're black.
You must play basketball, right?
It vacillates between extreme fear and extreme infatuation.
Everyone wants to be black. But on the other hand, when it's time to be black, no one wants to be black because...
Black men.
Black men.
Black men.
Are... Monkeys.
Problems.
Thugs.
But that is not who I am.
To me, being a black man in America means to be afraid.
You have to subject yourself to being less than a human being in order for someone else to feel better about themselves.
Whenever I see a white female on the street, if I'm walking behind her, particularly if it's late at night, I actually go out of my way to not only pass her, but to pass her as wide as I can so that she can see me clearly and so that she can see that I have nothing in my hands.
I'm tired of hearing that we make up the hatred and mistreatment that we receive from people in power.
And the fact that if you're 15 years old and black and you're walking down the street with a hoodie on, you could be a target of some kind of a harassment.
I feel like we have targets on our backs.
Black men.
Black men.
Black men.
Are not.
Just rappers, athletes. We're not all great dancers.
Black men are intelligent.
Multifaceted.
Individuals.
Compassionate.
A person just like anybody else.
This
is who I am.
And then you see that these are medical students, these are lawyers, these are journalists, these are architects. That's what you didn't see. Now, yesterday I played a short piece about a woman scientist who talking about we're just a matter of molecules. That's it. All right? I believe that we're something else. And the only way to understand that we're that energy, a vital energy, vitalism, is to see people who've come into contact with their own vital energy by some life-changing experience. Let's hear from Anita Morjani in a TED Talk. I'm only going to play a small part of it because I'll give you the punchline at the end.
Such a thrill for me to be here, and I'm so happy to see all of you. You know, one of the biggest reasons that I'm happy to be here is because I shouldn't be alive today. I should have died on February the 2nd, 2006. That was supposed to be my last day here in this physical life. Because on that day, the doctors had told my husband and my family that I only had a few more hours to live. I was dying from end-stage lymphoma, which is a form of cancer of the lymph nodes. I had struggled with cancer for 4 years up to that point. For 4 years, this disease had devoured my body. It had traveled through my lymphatic system. It started with a lump in my neck, and then it spread throughout my lymphatic system. And by that point, by the end of 4 years, I had tumors, some of them the size of lemons, that had spread from the base of my skull, all around my neck, down into my chest, under my arms, and all the way to my abdomen. By that point also, even before I had gone into the coma, my lungs had been filled with fluid, and every time I would lie down, I would choke on my own fluid. My muscles had completely deteriorated. So I weighed about 85 pounds. I looked like just a skeleton with skin on. I had these big, gaping, open skin lesions where the toxins were oozing out of my body. I wasn't able to digest any food. I had a persistent low-grade fever. I couldn't walk because my muscles had been deteriorated, so I was constantly just lying down or being taken around in a wheelchair. I was connected to an oxygen tank all the time. I couldn't breathe without the aid of oxygen. And on that morning, on February the 2nd, 2006, I went into a coma. The doctors had said these were my final hours because now my organs had shut down. My organs were failing. So my family were told that if there was anybody that had to see me before I died, this was the time. Unbeknownst to everyone around me, though, even though it appeared that I was in a coma and my eyes were closed, I was aware of everything that was going on all around me. I was aware of my husband, who was distressed, but he was by my side holding my hand. I was aware of everything the doctors were doing. They were putting tubes in me. They were removing fluid from my lungs so that I could breathe easier. I was aware of every single thing that was happening. It felt as though I had 360-degree peripheral vision. I could see everything happening all around my body. But not just in the room where my body was, but even beyond. And it was as if I had expanded out of my body. I was aware of my physical body. I could see it lying there on that hospital bed. But I was no longer attached to that body. It felt as though I could be everywhere at the same time. It was like wherever I put my awareness, there I was. I was aware of my brother, who was in India. My body, I was in Hong Kong. This was happening to me in Hong Kong. My brother was in India and was rushing to get on a plane to come and see me. He wanted to see me before I took my last breath. And I was aware of that. I felt as though I was with him. I saw him on the plane. And then I also became aware of my father and my best friend, both of whom I had lost. Both of them had crossed over, had died. But I became aware of their presence with me, as though they were guiding me and communicating with me. One thing that I felt in this amazing, expansive state, I felt I was in like a realm of clarity where I understood everything. I understood why I had cancer. I understood that I was much greater, in fact, all of us are much greater and more powerful than we realize when we're in our physical bodies. I also felt...
And that's the most important point she makes, is that she had a consciousness exceeding her physical presence. She had an awareness greater than the disease racking her body. A week later, she was up out of bed. 2 weeks later, all cancer was gone in her body, totally healthy and well. This is a historical and medical reality. Now, compare that to yesterday, that we're just elements, protons, neutrons, electrons. That's it. We're the descendants of burned-out planets. I say that's not all. We are life forces. We have energy. And surrounding ourselves with positive energy, sharing our spiritual energy, because science has never defined a spiritual energy. The only thing missing when you're dead is your energy. Everything else is there. The electrons, protons, neutrons there, but the energy that defines life, we do not discuss, and we should. For those of us who believe in the power of energy, the power of healing, the power of giving, the power of love, then there's a lot more people who've gotten up out of bed who were supposed to die and are alive and well today because they finally are aware of how important, significant their life is. More on this on our next program. Let's end with my favorite music, one that touches the soul.
Let me hear the worshipers! Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to
put your hands together, because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go. It's who I got. Every word of worship. With one accord. Every praise. Every praise. It's who I got. Come on, everybody. Sing hallelujah. To our God. Glory, hallelujah. It's to our God. Come on, say every praise. Say every praise. It's to our God. Y'all know how we do it. Take it up. Every praise. It's to our God. Every word of worship. With one accord. Come on, say every praise. Every praise. It's to our God. I want everybody all over the world to sing hallelujah. To our God. To our God, every praise, every praise, is to our God. Let's take it up one more time. Every praise, come on, everybody. Every word of worship, with one accord. Every praise, is to our God.